Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by Boston University African American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies programs. Speaking will be Dr. Osene Alidu, Director of the Rutgers University Center for African Studies. Dr. Alidu's lecture is titled Reformist Muslim Women Leaders in Kenya. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University African American Studies Program Director, Dr. Linda Haywood.
I want to welcome this afternoon our speaker, Osene Alidu, Associate Professor in the Department of African, Middle Eastern, and South Asian Languages and Literature, and Director of the Center for African Studies at Rutgers. She was the recipient of the 2010 Distinguished Alumni Award of the African American Institute, a U.S.-based organization dedicated to the promotion of capacity building in Africa through higher education and training. The award was presented to Professor Alidu on December 10, 2010, at the Institute's 26th annual gala in New York City, in recognition of her scholarly accomplishments and her work in helping to shape the material and intellectual lives and perspectives of young people, especially women from all walks of life across the United States, in African countries, and in other parts of the world. Professor Alidu's research focuses mainly on the study of women's discourses and literary practices in Afro-Islamic societies, African women's agency, African women's literatures, gendered discourses of identity, and the politics of cultural production in Francophone African countries. In 2006, Professor Alidu was awarded the Rutgers University Board of Trustees Fellowship for Scholarly Excellence in recognition of her significant contributions in the area of linguistics, literature, and culture and gender studies, particularly her highly innovative interpretations of Islam related to women and of new individual and collective social practices in Africa. Her book, Engaging Modernity, Muslim Women and the Politics of Agency in Postcolonial Niger, published at Madison University Press 2005, was a runner-up for the ASA 2007 Women's Caucus Edu Snyder Book Award, and it explores women's agencies through their contribution in religious and secular education, public politics, and the performing arts. Professor Alidu's current research project is on Kenyan Muslim women's discourses on citizenship and human rights. Professor Alidu's topic today is reformist Muslim women leaders in Kenya. And I want to welcome Professor Alidu because I took 2 years of Hausa and I welcomed her today, Sanu, because that's what I remember after 2 years. But she was able to answer me, and it's just my pleasure to answer you. She responded. Thank you very much. Give it up for her.
Thank you very much. Today, I'm going to shift to East Africa, where my research has gone for several reasons, including the personal, because I spend a great deal of time, too, in Kenya, because that's part of my family now. I come originally from the Sahel, but now I'm interested in the Indian Ocean. What does it mean to be a Kenyan Muslim woman, and how is it articulated through the work, the field work that I'm doing? Specifically, narrowing my talk to the reformist Muslim women leaders, Muslim women who have taken a great deal of role in a social transformation that have impact on a contemporary Muslim women and Muslim girls in a number of areas, such as education, such as the religious field, and the law, and politics. I wanted to start first by beginning to explain that this concept that geography geography matters a great deal in terms of identity. When we talk about African Muslim women, we have to be very differentiated. Even though I'm an African Muslim woman, for instance, from sub-Saharan Africa, more specifically from the Sahel, the experience of Muslim women of the Sahel that I covered in my previous book, Engaging Modernity, although it may have overlapping similarities with Muslim women in Kenya, there are fundamental differences because of geography and because that geography is mediated by different type of histories. Islam in West Africa, Sahel, is affected both by the Sahara Desert. So you look at Islam from the southern Mediterranean, crossing North Africa all the way to the Sudanic belt, the Sahel, from the Atlantic all the way to Djibouti. Okay, that's the Sahel. When we talk about Kenya, the Muslim women identities that I'm going to talk about are shaped by the ocean. Here you have the desert in the west. In East Africa, it is the Indian Ocean shaping how Muslim women, contemporary Muslim women's identity is framed. It is also the Arabian Peninsula. When we look at the map of Africa on the East African side, you can see how Kenya is looking at South Asia. Kenya is looking at the Arabian Peninsula. So the Arab Emirates has a lot of impact on how the identity of Kenyan Muslim women operate. So the type of Islam that we are talking about in Kenya, you have to look at Islam, even if it is an Islam that is predominantly Sunni, for instance, coastal Swahili and coastal Muslim like the Digo, the Taita, and other ethnicities of the coast. It is shaped by South Asia and the Arab Peninsula. So when we talk about Sunni Islam is differentiated too. West Africa, you have it's predominantly Sunni Islam. In East Africa, you have Sunni Islam, but you have also Shia Islam. So Muslim women, when we talk about the predominance of the type of Islam that is affecting, let's say, the Swahili women or the Digo women or the Somali women, we're talking about Sunni Islam within the different school of thought, the four school of thought. And then you have to think of the racial dimension of East African Islam in the sense that you have also a Kenyan of South Asian background who are predominantly Shia Muslim. So if you are talking about, for instance, the Bohora, the Itnasharis, or the other groups that are linked to the South Asia, the Asian, the Kenyan Asian, their identity is more linked to Shiism. But they are within the same cultural landscape, so they borrow from each other. So I talk about, Arab Peninsula and the racial and ethno-linguistic diversity of Kenyan Muslim and then the Indian Ocean factor. Coastal Muslim communities, for instance, the predominance is Sunni. So the Swahili Arab or the Arab Swahili or the African Swahili, the majority are at the coast. And I'm deliberately manipulating those concepts because depending on who is talking about the Swahili, they may find the Swahili to be African or they may find the Swahili to be Arab or the Swahili themselves may define themselves in other terms. So it's very important to see why is it like that. So the racial dimension is important. And this Arabness that we are talking about, it's really in relationship to the presence of the Arab Peninsula. Then you have a minority group at the coast. Because very often you talk about Kenyan Muslims, what comes to mind is the Swahili. But the Swahili are not the only Muslims in Kenya. So I work, for instance, with Digo women, Taita women, Pokomo, and others, who, when you talk about now question of identity and citizenship, you look at the coast. Within the coast, the Swahilis are majorities. Yes, within the nation, they're minority. But at the coast, they're majority. And their history in relationship to other Muslims is mediated through the concept of slavery, too. How is that weight of history affecting women's solidarity in contemporary life. So that becomes important. So the Muslims who are minority within the coast are the Digo, the Taita, and other groups. So minority-ness is double. You are minority within your region, but you are minority within the nation. This is very important. Whereas the Swahili are majority within the region, but minority within the nation. That has an implication in terms of the type of struggle for citizenship and recognition for women. Then we talk about the Kenyan of South Asian, who are predominantly Shia. You have the Ismaili, the Ethnasharis, the Bohara, and other groups. And then you have, among them, minority Sunni, who identify more with the Swahilis and the Digos because of their Sunniness. Then among the Somali, Kenyan, these are very often when people think of Somali people in general, they think that they belong to other citizenship, Somaliland. But it has to be differentiated because there are Somalis who are Kenyans. Their citizenship, the land, the eastern province is within Kenya. So in that sense, to think of them as not Kenyan is actually problematic when we are talking about the disenfranchisement in terms of citizenship rights. And then within that kind of framework, also the women told me, okay, Hussaina, you know, Somaliness even within Kenya, you have to understand there are Somali from the eastern province who are predominant, the major group of Somalis. And then there are Somalis who came to Kenya in the 1800s as part of a British regiment to quench a mutiny. And then they were placed in what they call mainland Kenya, in Kisumu. So those Somalis are recognized by these other Somalis as Somalis who are more identified with Kisii people because they are in a place which is not the native land. So indigeneity, they are not in their indigenous place. So you can imagine what it means for a Somali woman of that history to be placed in Kisumu and in areas which are not recognized in terms of indigeneity. Okay, so every time that I introduce a group, it's also important to think of the impact of the last election in Kenya, which is really a contestation about land, and it is a contestation in terms of belonging, citizenship, and right to access to the land and resources that are associated with that. So what happens to a woman of this particular background who is in that contested space, remoted from the eastern province, and also remoted from the Somali land, which usually when people talk of Somali, you are looking at them into Somalia, forgetting about the whole struggle that is happening there. So they're saying if within our own nation states, we are being classified as refugees, even though we are Kenyan citizens, and we are Somalis of a different background. Okay, so I want to come back to this, actually, last point. So there are Muslims who are born into Muslim families, but we are talking about the post-colonial condition. They are the reverts, which are the people who were not born into Muslim families, but who decided to convert to Islam more recently. So they talk of themselves not as converts. They don't want people to identify them as converts. They say we are reverts. Reverts meaning that they have always been Muslims. It's just because of the fact of British colonialism, which brought Christianity, that pushed them to stray away from their original religion to become a revert. I think that that concept resonates also with the Rastafarian approach for people who are studying Rastafarians. You hear a lot about reverts. So it's the same concept that they are using. And it is a product of the rise of political Islam, and it's a play with educated people and transnationalism and cosmopolitanism, where people are, Muslim women, young women are encountering non-Muslim in schools and at work or at the market or in different places, and these are embracing Islam and converting, even though their families are not Muslims. So I wanted to look at that within the framework of cultural production of the educated Muslim person in the post-colonial dispensation. In the colonial time, Victorian ideologies in general, when the first school were brought in, the women were not absorbed in school. Because colonial education, colonial policy in terms of education, the goal was to produce a cheap labor, an educated cheap labor who will participate in a colonial economy. So the target was first the male, whether it's Muslim or non-Muslim. And in terms of cultural ideologies also, so as the colonial ideology come with its Victorian notion of what the proper, the good woman should be or the good girl should be, then it did not create clash because the women are supposed to be, are considered within a patriarchal framework which did not prioritize them. Even though in pre-colonial time, African women, African girls, and the same, the gender ideology in terms of participation in the labor for communal production was not did not disenfranchise women and the girls, but this new framework did, and the education for the women came at the second stage. For Muslim, for the Muslim people, there is an added dimension that colonial education was one of the mission was to promote Christianity. So for the Muslims, it was a problem to send their school. Especially the girls, because of this ideology that the girls and the women are the custodian of tradition. So when there was a bargaining between the Muslim and the Sultan of Oman, who was in control of the Kenyan coastal strip, not to really force colonial education, especially on the girls, because of this particular the general cultural location of girls and women. And it has a consequence in the post-colonial dispensation when we are looking at the ratio of non-Muslim majority women who had access to education versus Muslim girls and Muslim women who are lagging behind when you look at the numbers in post-colonial dispensation. But during the post-independence era, the state really tried to catch up in terms of forcing, in terms of pushing for the compulsory education massification, which is very important for the development of independent African state. So that experience for promoting girls' education across ethnicity and across across religion was something that was also not specific to Kenya, but even in other areas we witnessed that. But it had a positive side for Muslim women because the long-term effect of education is what we are finding out now in terms of the type of women that I'm talking about who are using the gain from education in order to transform their own society and the nation state. So who are the reformist Muslim women? We find that they are senior and young women emerging from grassroots mobilization within both secularist, Islamic, or even Islamist, an overlapping framework. Okay, so they're emerging also outside the traditional aristocracy. Because before, you find that most of the leadership, when we talk about even the Leso movement that in the works of Margaret Strobel, who wrote about three Swahili women, she talks about there is a passage where Muslim women organized during the colonial period a Leso movement. Leso is this material that the kanga that is very symbolic for the Swahili women. It's two pieces. They use it for wedding. It's the site where they mark the proverbs. It's a part of really Swahili women's identity, especially in terms of rituals. So it is the protest was against the textile company during World War II, when there was high inflation and then the price of textile went high. So there was a leader within the Swahili community who emerged and then organized the women who were part of the what Margaret Stobel called the Lele Lama, which is the Women's Dance Association, to protest against the British and the Indian textile company. This is almost similar to the Gandhian protest against the textile company during his struggle to acquire independence for India. So they also used that model. But I'm saying these are not still those women who organized that protest, even though they mobilized other grassroots women who are not part of the aristocracy, the leadership is part of the traditional aristocracy, like the Mazruis and the Abu Saidi, etc. I'm saying these new women that I'm talking about are not part of that traditional aristocracy. They emerge out of actually the class that usually try to struggle against the traditional aristocracy. What made the difference is really the opportunities that they have, the access to education and the social mobility that education afforded, and how they're using education as the tool to transform their own societies before even they start to engage the state. Their aim is to have social transformative social change in areas related to Muslim women's rights. For instance, within the community of faith, the new Muslim women leaders want to new feminization of Islamic education. For instance, we know that in many Muslim societies, women have access to Islamic literacy, etc., but they are not authorities. It's one thing to say I can read and write the Quran, but it's another thing to say that I am an authority. I have the title to be claimed the teacher, the ulama, the alim. So these new women are saying that they authorize themselves to place themselves at the center of leadership, to see themselves as teachers, as knowledgeable individuals who also can claim themselves equally with male ulamas. So that's a new stand, which actually at the beginning created even clash among the women groups, in the sense that the traditional aristocratic women are responding more to the aristocratic framework. Whereas these women who are coming out are trying to subvert that hierarchy, are saying, no, we do not have to wait for you to authorize us as a mualim. And actually, they prove themselves, because now if you have a wedding or if you have ceremonies and we are looking for women who can come and recite the Quran or who can come and make important commentaries about an Islamic stand, it's not from the traditional ulama societies, it's from the grassroots. These other classes, sometimes also from the former slave societies, but who had access to education, and they come and say, I'm a knowledgeable person. And it is a public display of Islamic knowledge and Arabic language and English language. The mastery of English language in mediating Islamic knowledge, it becomes very important, because the Quran is translated and you have all this techno-orality that is becoming very fundamental in access to knowledge, which cannot be controlled by any kind of aristocratic ulama. So here Islam is Islamic knowledge, religiosity, is mediated through secularism, because it is through the secular education that also they develop skills in invading the religious space. That becomes very important. So that it's important that we don't talk always about the sharp divide between the secular space and the religious space, because now women are trying to use both space in a way that is a very strategic in order to achieve their goal within the domain either of religion or within the domain of education, to make claims that no religion prohibit for girls and Muslim girls to go to school, etc. And certainly in the domain of Muslim women as public political leaders. You have also national Muslim, the Muslim reformist Muslim women, leaders that I'm talking about are also dealing with the national women's community. One of the things that they say, as Muslim women, we are a minority in a tribe of women. when we talk about marginalization does not happen only because of a patriarchal structure. Marginalization can happen also in terms of the dominant framework within one's own gender. So women from dominant group, be it in ethnicity or be it they may be dominant not because of the number, but because of the privilege of history that they are aristocrats, the marginalization that happened. So I try to look at, okay, how these reformist Muslim women leaders are trying to transform that. They address first the marginalization and they develop tools for transforming them. Then they engage the state. So the state interlocutor, as far as these Muslim women are concerned, the state interlocutors are always represented by the leaders, the aristocracy. So they try to say, no, we are citizens of Kenya. We are citizens within an ummah. Even if we look at citizenship from within Muslim community, they say we have the right also to inscribe our own voices. It's important that through this democratization process, it's important that I mention that the period that I'm looking at is the 1990s when Kenya started to experiment with democratic pluralism. And they said, okay, we can no longer continue to be represented only by the chief qadi or by a certain ulama or by a certain king. We too can represent ourselves. Those are the transformative social changes that they're trying to achieve. So there, here it is in Pumwani. I'm interested in the emergence of a member of parliament, Amin Abdallah, who is here with another member of parliament, who is both of them are very famous. This is Njoki Ndugu. Who are here in Pumwani trying to do workshops on the sexual offense bill. So what my interest is to try to look at, okay, what are the communities, the target communities that these Muslim women MPs are trying to empower, and whether they do the empower from top down or from bottom up. And so here... I find that both Amina Abdallah and Njoki Ndugu, there is one aspect that very often people don't talk about, that there is a coalition beyond a religious identity between Muslim women and non-Muslim women in politics. And this is one of the examples over one very contentious issue, which is the sexual offense bill, which try to look at the right of women within the domestic, within the public space, when issues of sexual violence, gender-based violence are being implicated, and how they develop critical literacy skills, legal literacy skills, and social work literacy skills in order to empower women in this particular space. So I'm trying to mediate, to look at the relationship within Muslim women in parliament, that space called the parliament, and that space outside in society. And so this is the place of one. There are two Muslim women in parliament at the time I was doing my research, Amina Abdallah and Naomi Shaban, who become now a minister. So the rise of Muslim women in political space is some of the things that are important here. So here, Amina Abdallah that we saw from the Pumwani slum where she and Ndugu are working, we see her rising to become the president of the Commonwealth Women. But this is one of the only two Muslim women in parliament out of the 200 members, MP. So I talk about the revolt. Wanjiku is a young Kikuyu woman lawyer who is a revolt. Her parents are not Muslim, they're Christian. But she said, I like Islam, and through my Muslim friends, I decided to study it, and I become a Muslim. I wanted to give you that profile too. And her leadership is both in the law and also in terms of really now trying to look at the place, the right of the revert within the Muslim communities, because there is a whole contestation whether you are the proper Muslim and this and that. So the rivers come through textual knowledge of Islam. So for me, as somebody interested in critical literacy, you see that here is somebody who is not born within Islam, but who had a really serious engagement with the Quran, with the Hadith, and with Arabic language, with so many texts that are very fundamental in shaping this Muslim identity, whereas the born into may not even know it. So the tension within that space is something that I was trying to look at. And it became very interesting because the river, the impact of the river, the leadership of the river in empowering Muslim women, the born into who before did not have knowledge in Islam, but because of the river effect, now they're engaging with scriptural Islam, and it's helping them in terms of making legal claims about their right within Islam. So this is a very important terrain to explore. Yeah. So, and I want to also to show that the rivers are not only Muslims, only Kenyans born into Kenya. The rivers comes from somewhere else too. This one happens to be a Dutch of Dutch background, and she's a journalist, and she produces so many of the women's magazine. When you go to Kenya, you are looking at women and the media. You find Yvonne's production of her magazine, which features many women politicians. So that becomes very important also to look at this dimension. What are the areas that interest her, and how is it important in terms of her background as a journalist, or her background as somebody coming from Holland, which has been also a contentious space about Islam, now trying to embrace Islam within the Kenyan space in a certain framework. I was very interested in that, and we had a long discussion. Yeah. So within the space of education, the leaders here are, for instance, B. Sophia Mohashemi, Bibi, is someone who went to... she was the first Muslim woman educated in Kenyan coast, in Mombasa, to attend what is called the Catholic schools run by the Goan. So when we are talking about Kenyans' identity here, here is a Muslim woman who went to a Catholic school, but this Catholic school was a Catholic school by Kenyan of South Asian descent, from who originated from Goa. So transnationalism and diasporic identity and how it reconfigured Muslim women's identity was very important. She served in Kenyan's education, in the secular education, throughout her numbers of years, more than three decades. When she retired, she was upset, tired with the rise of political Islam and seeing that, okay, this conservatism, the Wahhabism is gaining terrain. And she said, I have to do something about it. The first thing is to go and try to transform the madrasas. So she developed this curriculum called the Integrated Madrasa Curriculum, which tried to inject a secular content in a Quranic school and training of the Quranic teachers. And then also trying to show that actually Muslim women are knowledgeable and they can appropriate the Quranic school. So it becomes a contentious thing because now when you are talking about who becomes the teacher, it's also a question of employment. So she's producing a mass of young Muslim women who sometimes are dropped out from secondary school or high school because they cannot continue. They say, come back, I train you to become the Quranic teachers. She got funding from, interestingly, here is a Sunni woman, but get funding from the Aga Khan Foundation, which is Ismaili. And the Ismailis, the Aga Khan Foundation is very supportive of educational initiative. So when we talk about denomination, for me it's important to look at why is it that B. Safia, instead of having support from the Sunni community, she gets support from the Ismaili community, where the Sunnis are open to her ideas of transforming the traditional framework of the Mualim. And so here, because she couldn't get their support, then she turned to the Ismaili and developed her modernized curriculum. So for those who are middle class, they also develop literacy. Here, challenging. This is a kindergarten teacher up kindergarten to fifth grade in Pangani. And Mariam decided to open her school because she said many Muslim girls are not going to school because parents are afraid what will happen to their daughters. So if the issue is just to allow the child to learn how to pray, I'm going to create that space. So she bought a small house and transformed it into a school and created a space where she teaches when it is break time, when it's prayer time, she teaches the children how to do salah. Meanwhile, she has her school. Yeah. So that she said, this is one of the ways you cannot continue always to talk about the marginalization of Muslim because of education. The Muslim also have to invest. So some of us who had access to education, we have to give back to our communities. So she opened this private school, which now it started as a Muslim school, but now she has even a Christian school and other children from other communities. It's called The Little Bird. So when you go to Pangani, you will find it. And the only difference that she did, it's not about bringing Quran or else, it's just teaching the children that how to pray. If that will allow the parent to have a peace of mind to send them to school, she does it. Here is Amina Abubakar. And she is the host of this radio program called Ukumbi Wa Mama, The Voice of Women. And in that, there are all sorts of debates about Muslim women and women and women's rights. And this is a radio called Radio Rahama. And it is a site where you have all sorts of debates about the issues of women's rights that are going on. So at the beginning, the Muslim communities, they thought that it was wonderful. But the more that it was becoming really tough on issues that are problematic within the society, like the right of women, then they start to say, okay, maybe they should not allow these women to continue to talk. But it was too late because it has catching on, democratization has catching on, and they couldn't stop her program. Actually, BBC tried to entice her to join them. Here, Nazlin Omar Rajput, Behind the Veil program. This is Nazlin Omar Rajput. Sexuality and reproductive health is a contested area within of discussion, both within Muslim framework and also within Christian framework. Even when the secular state is trying to develop programs in terms of sensitization about the HIV pandemics and its impact. So they will hide always behind the religion to say that, no, we cannot talk about sex, etc. So Nazlin Rajput decided, I'm going to create the Noor. The Noor is the light. For some of you who know Arabic, it's the light. I'm going to enlighten people. And the sexuality is going to be addressed through an Islamic framework. And she brings it to the fore. And so she created this network called Behind the Veil to try to give also a kind a very dignified, using the ethics of care to address the issue of what happens to what is being called the victims of circumstances. All these Muslim women who are respectable, observing piety, etc., and yet they become affected because within the cultural framework, if women have to guard themselves to be pious in their sexuality, this is not the same requirement for men. So what happens to that? So she uses the Islamic framework to address that. And she developed media production is very important in that campaign, that their leadership program, because they're trying to use every religious text to make their claim, both combining Islam and secularism in order to argue for the right of Muslim women to say, through the ethics of care within an Islamic framework, I have the right to protect myself so that I do not become infected or affected by HIV/AIDS. So here what she does, this is Nazlin, and this is the chief qadi. So before, you cannot even talk about sex. She said, okay, I'm not going only to talk about sex, but I'm going to bring the chief cadi to recognize that this is urgent, that we start to look at this this seriously, and for him to make a pronouncement and to force this ulama to come into our training. The issue is not just to train Muslim women. The issue is not. We have to train Muslim men and boys also to understand sexuality within Islam, and also the right of Muslim women to protect their reproductive health. So this is very important, because you see here, the young women who are part of her network, they are social work, they are nurses, some are doctors, women across class background and social walks of life who joined that campaign of Behind the Veil, and the ulamas also who come to support and get the training. Interestingly, where you are there, you find that most of them are Quranic teachers who really, beyond this domain of the Quran, they're not as, they don't have the training that the women have in terms of addressing this important issue. So it's a terrain of leadership that they're saying, women are knowledgeable as nurses, as doctors. We can help you so that you can use a religious argument to try to protect yourself. This is Nazaline. And Nazaline is also, she said, if since I'm already out there, let me be out completely. So she goes on a national radio, the private radio like the one Ukumbi Wa Mama. That's actually the first time how I first knew about her and decided to try to pursue her social biography and see how, et cetera. And she said, okay, Nazaline's background is what? Nazaline is mixed of Afghani background, and not a recent Afghani. This is the Afghani who came in the 1800 in Kenya, and part of her is Afghani. Part of her is mixed African ethnicities, Luo. And she said, "Okay, you know what? I have also the right to vie for presidency." And she did vie. So when she told me during my research, I thought, okay, she was just joking. But Nazaline was not joking. And she did. She said, I know that I'm not going to go any far, but I want, in the history of Kenya, to have it marked that a Muslim woman vie for presidency. And I'm this Muslim woman from this complex identity, because people want me to define myself. Okay, I am African, I am of Asian background, and I am a Muslim. She called herself Mama Orange. So this is, and you can see all the mediatic, the newspapers and all her campaign, whether it is in the area of HIV, AIDS, critical literacy, education, or her political life, she's important. So in fact, she was Mama ODM, because when we talk about the rise of Raila Odinga in Kenya, she was very fundamental in promoting his political agenda, and that's how she actually gained the name of Mama Orange. But by the time she decided that she's going to claim herself as a president, she was no longer useful to the Orange movement. So this was just having interviews, and so I want to move to the first Muslim woman who is a judge in the Supreme Court of Kenya. There is only one Muslim woman, and this is Justice Abida Ali. She was the first Muslim woman to become the vice chair and then chair of the Kenyan constitutional review process. And she said, I was the citizen of consensus. And this is how her social biography goes. She says, I am a lawyer by profession. I have practiced now for about 20 years. I'm married. I have 3 children. The eldest is a boy about 12 years old. I have a 10-year-old boy and 8-year-old daughter. I come from a Muslim family of mixed origin. My father came from the Comoros Island and settled in Kenya. My mother is partly African Kenyan and partly Goan of South Asian descent. My mother was a Goan. Her father was a Kenyan. and I'm married to from Nyanza, a place near Kisii, and she laughs. Yes, it's all mixed up. It is all mixed up. So I said, she said, I was born in Nairobi and I'm 45 years old. So this is Kenyan identity. Here, what is important is I wanted you to remember that she said her father is of Comoro origin, Comoro Island, right? And Comoro is a former French colony, but it's in the Indian Ocean. They are very close to the Swahilis. And then Kenya is a British colony, a part of the Commonwealth. Here you have Francophonie, right, coming to merge with Commonwealth. When the Comoros community, there is a diasporic community in Kenya who get harassed. So she said, I'm going to represent them. I'm going to take up the position of the consular office to help them. She's a lawyer by training, and she fought it out. She said, my father is from Comoros, right? So they appointed her. So she said, at some point, I saw that the Muslim community of Kenya, when the democratic process was taking shape and they were going through this constitutional review process, they were looking for a strong Muslim who can represent the Muslim position. And they thought I should be the one. So she left the fight to become this the consular officer to represent the Comoros to claim her Kenianness. And then she get inscribed into national politics as this Muslim woman who is going to present the Muslim agenda. And the Muslim agenda was what? The want that the constitution recognize the Cadiz Court so that the Sharia will be maintained within a secular constitution. So here is somebody, she said, I was not really a political mind, but being a representative, all of a sudden, because of my educational background, because I'm a successful lawyer, even though I'm a minority, I do not come from the coastal aristocracy, but the Muslim consultative body find me useful, and so they appointed me to represent the Kenyan Muslim into this process of Kenyan constitutional review process. She became the chair, the vice chair of the process, and the chair was another person of a minority background, Yash Guy, who is not a Muslim, but of Asian background, which becomes very interesting if you are looking at identity politics, citizenship, and the constitutionalism in Africa and the contribution of minorities, which are very often not even being into consider into the process. So when Yash Guy resigned in protest that the process the government wanted to tap into the process, she became appointed as the chair. So the struggle for her, she did not want to actually protect the Cadiz Court. So to me, this becomes very fascinating as we are looking at what constitutes leadership and how does a leader emerge. What are the theoretical framework to look into, and what are the parameters, the conditions that will allow the emergence of this leader to emerge, and whether an individual can claim their autonomy, autonomous agency to inscribe themselves as leaders, and therefore to have an impact that brings the community to support them as they are working to support the community. So this is where my work is at the moment, and I'm trying to say, okay, the Indian Ocean actually is a really a very fascinating sight in a number of ways. For instance, the area of marriage, I was talking with Professor Ari earlier, where Abida Ali tried to work at. She said, look, if I do not address this issue of the Cadiz Court now that I'm in this position, it's going to be a problem because we have diversity of marriage system. You have the Siri marriage, which is the secret marriage. We have the normal open marriage. And then we have the temporary marriage. And this, so what happens is you have to understand, see remarriage as very problematic, which is the marriage that takes place without the other partners knowing. Yeah, she said it's a very it makes women extremely vulnerable. And I have to address that as a really un-Islamic, because within Islam, the contract said you have to be open about the marriage. But temporary marriage is different, because you have this notion of what is called the discordant marriage, the discordant discordant identities between Muslim men and Muslim women. More and more Muslim women are performing higher in school. And the more they attain a higher level of education, the more they become vulnerable in terms of marriageability. Because marriage education becomes now something that is used against them. But so what they do is they become unequal partners. Higher education, well, Muslim men are not performing as high as Muslim women. So, but at the same time, we are discussing this need, part of the human need, to have companionship. How are Muslim women going to address that? And then the other type of regulated marriage, but where you don't have a legal contract, becomes a problem, and she's forcing the Sharia court within the constitution to have a defined notion of rights of women. Yeah. So thank you. I just would like to stop here.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You have just heard a lecture by Dr. Asene Alidu, director of the Rutgers University Center for African Studies. Dr. Alidu's lecture was titled Reformist Muslim Women Leaders in Kenya and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies programs. Tonight's moderator was Boston University African American Studies Program Director, Dr. Linda Haywood. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Tota and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lightodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.